This is Brian Cambria with news for the Western Slope, Wednesday, May 15th, 2013. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that while last month's snow showers brought some relief to the parched Colorado high country, speakers at the State of the Rivers meeting on Monday said they look more like an aberration than a trend. Aldis Stroutens, a hydrologist with the National Weather Service, told about 60 people that if it hadn't been for April, we would have been in a real bad spot, to quote him. The immediate and longer-term outlook, however, is less like April and more like a continuation of the drought. Stroutens said forecasts for the May, June, July period are for greater probabilities for higher than normal temperatures and less precipitation. The probabilities run as well toward higher than normal temperatures for the June, July, August period. Eric Knight, hydrologist with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, said even with the April snowfall, the likelihood of major reservoirs filling is remote. This spring's runoff will also be muted. Knight said, based on current estimates, Green Mountain Reservoir, which is frequently used to supplement summer flows through the Grand Valley, is likely to reach the 89% full mark. On the Gunnison River side of the Grand Valley, Paonia Reservoir is likely to fill, but Taylor and Blue Mesa reservoirs are not. The Aspinall Unit, a series of reservoirs on the Gunnison, including Blue Mesa, is a major storehouse of water for the state and is managed in part to ensure that Colorado releases enough water to meet its obligations to the 1922 compact under which the Colorado River is managed. It was 41% full as of Monday. Low snowfalls overall will contribute to about 3 million acre-feet of water flowing down the Colorado River system into Lake Powell. According to Knight, that's about 42% of the long-term average. And now in this report from the Sounds of the High Country, KDNK's Nelson Harvey talks to author Sierra Crane Murdoch about her High Country News cover story on radical conservatism in political polarization in northern Idaho.
We hear all the time that our politics in the United States have become more polarized and more divisive. Yet we hear a lot less about exactly why that's happening and about the effect that it has on our everyday lives. Perhaps no place is more polarized than Kootenai County, Idaho, the most Republican county and the most Republican state in the nation. When Sierra Crane Murdoch went there recently, she wanted to know just how a former mining town, once dominated by left-leaning unions, had recently become so conservative. What she found was the aftermath of a demographic perfect storm. In the early 1990s, nearly 1.5 million people had left California and moved to the Intermountain West. They did so to escape the turbulence and economic stagnation then plaguing the state, and many of them fit a particular political profile.
California in the early 90s especially was experiencing a whole host of sort of small disasters, an earthquake, a lot of fires. They also had race riots in 1992, and also a major recession. So there was a huge exodus of people from Southern California, from in fact its most conservative counties, to all parts of the Intermountain West, and Idaho got a big piece of that. It became their promised land. It became the place where they were escaping, basically, from an America that had sort of disappeared as they once knew it.
The transition in Idaho mirrored something that's actually been happening across the American political landscape for decades. Often for lifestyle reasons, people have been moving into communities full of people like them, people who share their values, and as it happens, often their political beliefs as well.
So the most obvious, or the best statistic sort of showing this shift, is that in 1976, less than a quarter of Americans lived in counties that voted overwhelmingly, so by more than a 20% margin, for one presidential candidate. And by 2004, nearly half of Americans did.
Once they got to northern Idaho, many conservative Californians began shaping the political landscape in their image. One group called Rally Right vetted candidates for all levels of government using a document they called the Conservative Creed, which tested their opposition to abortion and gay rights, their belief in God, and their stance on the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. Over more than a decade, such groups worked their way from the bottom of the ballot to the top. In 2010, the last Democrat to hold local elected office, the Kootenai County Clerk, was voted out. Without much of an opposing party to challenge their positions, many Republicans in Kootenai County have continued to move further to the right. Murdoch writes about one parent named Tom Hamilton, who was radicalized by the fact that his daughter's school curriculum was partly based on the International Baccalaureate, or IB, program, a set of educational standards aimed at making students into so-called global citizens.
Well, his daughter came home from school one day and told him that her teacher had said, if your parents take you to church, essentially, they're teaching you to believe in ghosts and fairy tales. And he obviously was incensed. He thought that schools should not be teaching his children to question parents' values, that was the role of the parent, and schools rather should just stick to, you know, the basic topics.
Hamilton was so incensed that he actually got himself elected to the school board, where he led a successful charge to abolish the county's IB programs. Yet after about a year on the school board, he did something unexpected when he voted to approve a bond measure that would generate money for local schools. Surely the bond would require government spending, something Hamilton was often highly suspicious of. Still, he'd come to see that the school was already strapped for cash and needed money to stay effective. Murdoch says this modest evolution suggests that when you get down to the nitty-gritty of local politics, the school budgets and public parks, the sharp lines that divide our national politics begin to soften.
Once people, no matter what their party affiliation is, become responsible in their own community for keeping a school running, for providing sewer services to a city, for simply making things continue to work, I think there's, you know, actually a lot less disagreement than there is agreement on how to move forward. Come together.
For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Nelson Harvey.
The Associated Press reports that private organizations that help connect children in need with foster care families and potential adoption homes are struggling in western Colorado. Carrie Over works for Ariel Clinical Services, a private organization that helps local municipalities connect children in need with foster care families and potential adoption homes. She said she and her co-workers are having trouble meeting the demand. Quoting Over, "A lot of the burden is falling on our foster parents, and more we are seeing foster families who've been given too much and want to quit," end quote. Over said that in addition to fostering homes being overloaded, some children are ending up in families, quote, "that aren't the best match." But she and her co-workers said it's better than nothing. According to the Montrose Daily Press, drug abuse, mental illness, homelessness, and domestic violence have increased demand for foster care services in Montrose, Mesa, and Delta counties. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that ozone levels in Rio Blanco County have violated federal limits and, according to the environmental group Wild Earth Guardians, this is the first time for western Colorado. The high ozone levels were detected at a monitor in Rangeley and trigger stricter air pollution controls and the mandate on the state to clean up the pollution. The Environmental Protection Agency has said an emerging wintertime ozone problem in Rio Blanco County may be related to oil and gas development in the Uinta Basin just over the border in Utah. Wild Earth Guardians says Colorado's Air Pollution Control Division is scheduled to discuss the Rangeley findings to the Air Quality Commission Thursday. According to Wild Earth Guardians, ozone is a key ingredient of smog and forms when air pollution from vehicles, smokestacks, and oil and gas drilling react with sunlight. It can cause respiratory problems in sensitive populations such as children, the elderly, and those with asthma, and can cause premature death. The standard for a violation to occur is complicated. According to the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, a violation occurs when the three-year average of the fourth highest annual ozone readings in an area, as measured over eight-hour intervals, exceeds 0.075 parts per million. Complicated. Wild Earth Guardians says Rangeley's average is now 0.077 parts per million. It says a monitor in nearby Vernal, Utah, this year recorded ozone concentrations above the standard 22 times. According to the Daily Sentinel, ozone monitoring sites within the Uinta Basin have not yet recorded three-year averages above federal standards, but that's because monitors that meet EPA quality assurance requirements have only been in place there for 2 years, and this year's top reading was high enough that Vernal is expected to exceed the three-year average next winter, even if it's a low ozone year. Ozone is more commonly a summertime problem in urban areas, but high wintertime readings also have been detected in rural Pinedale, Wyoming, and other areas of gas development. Sunlight reflecting off snow is thought to contribute to the problem. In a news release, Jeremy Nichols of Wild Earth Guardians said, quote, "With Colorado's western slope now violating federal smog standards, it's critical that the state respond quickly to restore our clean air and health of the state." According to test results reported in the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, benzene levels in Parachute Creek have shown consistent reductions in recent days. The reductions come as Williams continues to work with state regulators to strip the carcinogen from groundwater before it reaches the creek and to also remove benzene from the creek. The work follows the winter leak of what Williams estimates was about 10,000 gallons of natural gas liquids into soil and groundwater from a pipeline leaving its gas processing plant northwest of Parachute. Williams has been using aeration and pumping hydrocarbons from wells to help remove benzene and other contaminants. Newly installed vertical air sparge wells to treat groundwater benzene near the benzene's point of entry into the creek went into operation on Friday. The Durango Herald reports that Governor John Hickenlooper signed into law a $1 billion expansion of health care for the poor Monday. And thanks to the bill, an estimated 189,000 Coloradans will get government health insurance, or Medicaid. The expansion was one of the highest priorities for Democrats and is a key piece of implementing President Barack Obama's health care law in Colorado. Hospitals and doctors groups supported the bill, Senate Bill 200, because they think it will reduce the amount of charity care they have to provide at emergency rooms. The governor stressed no general tax money would be used to pay for the expansion. Instead, the federal government will pick up the full cost for the first 3 years, tapering down to 90% by 2020. An existing tax on hospitals will cover Colorado's 10% of the cost. But Republicans called the bill irresponsible for the state and national budgets. During the bill's debate on the Senate floor, Senator Ellen Roberts, a Republican from Durango, said Colorado, and especially the Four Corners, lacks enough doctors to provide the Medicaid patients already on the rolls, Roberts also said Colorado hasn't done enough to root out Medicaid fraud. Other Republicans, such as Senator Kevin Lundberg, had more fundamental objections. "It is one more step to the government controlling your medical life. I don't believe in that kind of socialist mentality," Lundberg said. The new law expands eligibility for Medicaid to people making 133% of the federal poverty level, up from a current 100%. The new cutoff line will be a yearly income of $14,856 for an individual or $30,657 for a family of four. The expansion was supposed to happen automatically through the Federal Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, but the U.S. Supreme Court threw out that portion of the law and left it to the states to decide whether to expand Medicaid. Senate Bill 200 passed in the legislature on highly partisan votes. No Democrat voted against it, and only one Republican voted for it, Senator Larry Crowder of Alamosa. Hickenlooper's signature on the bill was never in doubt. He called for Medicaid expansion during his State of the State address in January. Now, you've heard of farm to table. How about farm to glass? Luke Runyon reports.
You know, obviously we're still constructing, but...
Kyle Carbaugh stands in the middle of his half-finished brewery. Right now it's just bare floors, a framed bar, and four industrial-sized brew tanks. Carbaugh's been brewing small batches of beer out of his home for years and decided now was the time to expand.
If we start getting equipment, we have to have a place for that.
That place is a former cinder block factory in Greeley, Colorado. The area is already home to numerous microbreweries, including New Belgium Brewing in nearby Fort Collins. So Carbaugh says it became very clear he needed to be different.
At the end of the day, beer is an agricultural commodity through and through.
So he decided to hitch his brewery onto the local food bandwagon.
There's a huge thing going on with local food movement and, you know, farmers markets and know your farmer, that kind of thing. And the question came up to us is like, why isn't anybody doing this?
In fact, some places are doing it. Breweries in the Pacific Northwest have perfected the art of a farm-to-glass beer, but few have sprouted elsewhere.
This is all a Colorado product also.
While breweries focus on the art of brewing beer, Jason Cody is perfecting the art of craft malt, germinating grains which are combined with hops, yeast, and water to make beer. Inside his large malting shed in Alamosa, a vat the size of a small swimming pool is filled with rice.
What's that smell?
It's the rice. You can tell when things start happening metabolically in the seeds because you start getting those smells.
How good are you? Can you tell like a different malt by the smell?
Yeah, I can tell you if we're doing a Pilsner malt or a Belgian malt. You just get used to it, you know.
Since 2008, Cody's been malting barley and wheat from his own fields. He works with specialty grains too, like millet and quinoa. He then sells the bags of malt to craft brewers throughout Colorado, like Kyle Carbaugh, and business is booming.
The first full year we were in business, I think we sold 20,000 pounds inside the state of Colorado. And our projection for this year, which we're right on target with, is about 500,000.
But even 500,000 pounds isn't enough to satisfy brewery owners who want to create and sell a hyper-local beer.
There's only so many guys you can take care of. And those, you know, with brewers, it's repeat business. So they brew a beer, and then when it's time to brew again, they need more malt. So, you know, they got to come back and buy more malt, and that's great. But then it's hard to pick up new guys sometimes when you're in that position, because what do?
There's absolutely no way you can produce as much as these people want.
Steve Karoski is with the Colorado Brewers Guild. He says craft malting is just starting to take off, allowing breweries to source locally.
There's just so much beer being brewed now, and the movement to supply local hops and local grain is just kind of getting started.
So this is kind of the bar area.
At his unfinished brewery in Greeley, Kyle Carbaugh is still trying to navigate where his supplies will come from. His malt will be Colorado-grown, but his hops will come from Washington State. Eventually, he hopes to pour a completely Colorado-grown glass of beer.
It's really all about telling a story, right? Through a product or through materials.
And until his brewery opens this summer, Carbaugh will still be writing that story. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues and is a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. You can find other stories or comment on this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. And one final note this morning, Dave phoned in a cow patty alert for the Jumbo Trail. He's up there this morning and noted there are about 30 head of cattle up there doing cow things. So watch out. Don't step in any of that clean country air. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.